there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that has walked into the 12th canto of Purgatorio. We're going to be at lines 25 through 36, just 12 lines of this passage in Purgatorio Canto 12. If you remember, we are on the terrace of the prideful, those who are repenting of their pride, or to use Dante's terminology, paying back the debt. So somehow sin has become a debt that can be repaid. Interestingly, theologically, interestingly, metaphysically, interestingly, ethically, Virgil has told Dante to look down into the roadbed and he will see the road beneath his feet. And we're about to discover that this roadbed is carved. Remember, there were intaglios along the side of the mountain in Canto 10 when we first entered the Terrace of Pride, and now we're going to find carvings in the roadbed that you have to walk on. This is a long passage of many, many examples, and I've broken it down into short bits because when it got too long, it just got too unwieldy. There are too many figures here to talk about who are carved into the roadbed itself. When we had the three intaglios, it was easier because there were fewer of them. Now there are just going to be tons of these figures, three lines each. And so we might as well break these figures apart into three different episodes of this podcast to take them slowly. So this is my English language translation. As always, you can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. You can use my translation or another one, but otherwise we're setting off to see what's carved into the ground beneath our feet on the Terrace of Pride in Purgatorio, Canto 12, lines 25 through 36. I saw the one who was made nobler than any other creature. He fell like lightning from the sky over to one side. On the other side, I saw Briareus fixed in place by a celestial lightning bolt, now heavy on the earth in the chill of death. I saw Thymbraeus. I saw Pallas and Mars still suited up in armor, along with their father, all marveling at the scattered limbs of the giants. I saw Nimrod at the pediment of his grand work, seemingly lost and staring at the people who partook of his pride at Shinar. Four figures, well, actually more, that third tercet has three different figures in it. Okay, one, two, three, four, five, six figures then over the course of these 12 lines. We're going to look at them, and let me just explain how we're going to do this. I want to first answer the question, who are these figures carved into the roadbed? Then I want to talk about the artistry of this passage, and I want to talk a little bit about how it's crafted by the poet Dante. And then I want to divert into curiosities that arise from these figures, these first figures carved into the roadbed. And finally, we're going to end with a discussion of humility. And this discussion of humility is going to carry on through this episode and the next two episodes, through all the episodes of these figures carved into the roadbed. I want to talk to you about humility and some of the problems and also some of the benefits of calling humility a virtue. Let's start with the who, as I say. The first tercet is, I saw the one who was made nobler than any other creature. Now, any Christian in the Middle Ages would know instantly that this is Lucifer or Satan. He fell like lightning from the sky over to one side. And the lightning bit here is connected to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 10, verses 17 and 18. The disciples have been casting out demons and healing. They've been on a mission trip for Jesus. And they come back very proud of this. Oh my gosh, even the demons ran away from us. And Jesus deflates their balloon a little bit by saying, I was there when Satan or Lucifer fell like lightning from the sky. That's the lightning reference here, but it's got a larger artistic purpose, as we'll talk about. This first figure is Lucifer, Satan, who we've seen. We saw him at the very bottom of hell. And we assume that Satan fell out of heaven, fell all the way down Mount Purgatory when he fell, was driven into the earth at the center of the universe, and drove all the way through to the center of the earth, where now, if we flip the globe and put Italy on top, he's upright. And his face is sticking up, although he would have come down head first. There's a huge question here, one that we're not going to answer in this episode. But the question is, when did Satan fall? Did Satan fall before Adam and Eve fell? How did he miss the Garden of Eden on his way down? Or did he divert on his way down to the Garden of Eden and then continued falling? This is a problem in Christian theology that we will address much later in Purgatorio and then in Paradiso again. But we should just say, first figure is Satan. Second figure in the next three lines. On the other side, I saw Briareus, fixed in place by a celestial lightning bolt, now heavy on the earth in the chill of death. This is one of the giants who attempted to storm Mount Olympus. He is the son of Uranus and Gaia, or Gaia, Earth. The Uranus was his father. Uranus bled. The blood dripped onto Gaia, the Earth. The children, the giants, sprung up from this, and then they tried to lay siege to Mount Olympus. In one of the sources, Briareus was killed with a lightning bolt from Zeus, and he's fixed in place here by this lightning bolt, heavy on the earth in the chill of death. And we should just say we've seen him before too. He was one of the giants surrounding the pit, the final pit of hell, Cocytus. If you remember, Virgil pictures him as a many-headed, many-armed monster, and Dante morphs him into a more standard giant. We've seen Lucifer. We've seen Briareus. There was a little bit of fun there with Virgil and Dante in how exactly Briareus looks and who's right. Is it Dante or Virgil? But here he is again in Purgatorio, brought up. And then it goes on. In the next three lines, I saw Thymbraeus. Now, Thymbraeus is a nickname, a kind of funny nickname, but a nickname of Apollo. It's derived from Thumbra, depending on how you pronounce it, one of the temples of Apollo near Troy. So when he says, I saw Thymbraeus or Thymbraeus, he's saying Apollo, but he's using a circumlocution to say it. It's interesting. We'll talk about that as one of the curiosities in a minute. And he says, I saw Pallas, that is Athena, and Mars. So Apollo, Athena, Mars, still suited up in armor, along with their father, Jupiter, all marveling at the scattered limbs of the giants. This is what happens after the storming of Olympus. The giants storm it. It's thought that some of the giants, or maybe only Briareus, are cast down and buried under Mount Etna, but we know they're not really under Mount Etna. We know they're surrounding the pit of Cocytus. So we'll talk more about that in a minute. Here stands around other gods, Apollo, Athena, Mars, kind of wondering at the victory of their warfare. And then the final three lines, I saw Nimrod in Christian tradition, the founder and creator of the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. Now, there's some tenuous interpretation here, but let's just accept the major Christian interpretation that Nimrod is the one who created the Tower of Babel. So I saw Nimrod at the pediment of his grand work. So he's standing at the foot of the Tower of Babel in this relief, seemingly lost. Oh, there's that word from the opening of comedy itself, lost in the dark wood, seemingly lost, staring at the people who partook of his pride at Shinar. Again, we know Nimrod is amongst the giants standing around the rim of Cocytus. We saw him when he spoke his incredibly garbled, sort of Semitic speech on the rim of the last ring of hell. By the way, I should just add here as a side point, Nimrod is in every canticle. He is in Inferno. Here he appears in Purgatorio, and he will appear again in Paradiso. Nimrod is clearly important to the work of the poem. Why? Nimrod, language, Babel, scattering of languages, Dante, writing in the vernacular, medieval Florentine, one of those millions of languages that blow out from the Tower of Babel. He clearly functions as a linguistic node in the poem, but we should also note that Apollo is here. Apollo is the god of poetry, so there's a lot going on here about literature. Let's turn and look at the craft of these 12 lines. First of all, it's a traditional chiasmus, or an X. It starts with a biblical figure, Lucifer. It moves to a classical figure, Briareus. It then moves to more classical figures, Apollo, Pallas, Athena, Mars, Jupiter. And then it moves back to Nimrod, a biblical figure, biblical, classical, classical, biblical, like an X. If you were naming the four points of an X, top and then bottom, and the way the top right corner of the X connects to the bottom left corner of the X. It's a chiasmus. That is the rhetorical strategy. One piece of the artistry just has to do with the way the passages are linked. Satan falls like lightning. Briareus is fixed by a lightning bolt. Briareus is one of the giants who attack Olympus. The third tercet, we have Apollo, Pallas, Athena, Mars staring at those very giants. We have Pallas, Apollo, and Mars looking in wonder, marveling at the scattered limbs. And then we have Nimrod seemingly lost. So lightning leads to lightning, giant leads to giant, marveling leads to being slack-jawed and lost. It's connecting up through the passage. But we should also look more here because Dante has built more into it. Notice that the first character named Lucifer is solitary. He falls like lightning out of the sky. Notice the second character named Briareus is solitary, pinned down in the chill of death by this lightning bolt. Notice then that we get a crowd of people, Thymbraeus or Apollo and Pallas Athena and Mars and Jupiter. Notice that the third tercet is crowded. And notice the fourth tercet with Nimrod is even more crowded because he's staring at his grand work, the Tower of Babel, with all of these people. So solitary, solitary, pretty crowded, very crowded. We also notice that Lucifer falls on one side and Briareus falls on the other side, and it's very deliberate in the Florentine, one side and the other side. Basically, they're paired. We have a biblical figure on one side and a classical figure on the other. Does this mean that Dante is linking them? Kind of. This is the big problem for Dante. We want to talk about this in a minute. This is a big problem of how to deal with classical figures in a Christian context. But here he seems to be somehow equating Lucifer and Briareus. It's a weird connection to make, but he does make a bit of it with on the one side and on the other side. Now, true, that could be how the reliefs lie on the ground, but it's hard not to read that allegorically. And notice the first bit seems to be almost emotion. Lucifer falls like lightning from the sky, so it's not quite emotion, but just about emotion. Certainly the emphasis on the motion of the fall. And then notice it gets increasingly static. There's Briareus, and he gets fixed in place by a lightning bolt, so he's, you know, fixed onto the earth with Jupiter's lightning bolt. And then we have all of these gods standing around staring at the defeat of the giants who have been torn apart. Notice that it's getting more static, but this is static and a little positive. And then it gets even more static with Nimrod slack-jawed with all the people staring at the Tower of Babel and now unable to speak to each other from God's judgment. Dante is clearly crafting this piece. He's clearly creating it so that we kind of see it as a classical biblical hodgepodge, so that it moves in and out of solitary and crowded states, so that it moves from motion to stasis. He's making sure that we understand that this is highly constructed poetry, not just reliefs on the ground. And this will prove important as we go forward, because remember, the craftsman here is God. But the language used to describe it is Dante. And Dante's crafted language enhances God's art. But I'm not going to touch that for the moment. Now let's look at curiosities in this passage. The first one has to do with those figures, Apollo, Pallas Athena, Mars, and Jupiter. In fact, what's interesting is that this all comes out of a passage from Statius's Thebia, the Fall of Thebes. And in that passage, Statius mentions Briareus and then quickly goes on to talk about Apollo, Athena, and Mars. Dante is clearly got that passage somewhere in the back of his brain. Dante's working around that passage in the epic of the Fall of Thebes here. And I think we should think about proud Thebes, the way Thebes has always been held up as a city destined for destruction, much like Florence in Inferno. We should think about pride here and Thebes running around the background of this text, sitting kind of as a substrata of reference under the text. All of that is important and a curiosity to drawing out exactly what Dante means by pride and its counterpart, humility, which is the $25,000 question. Here's another curiosity in the passage. In that third tercet, I saw Thymbraeus, I saw Pallas and Mars, still suited up in armor along with their father. You'll notice that everybody else is, they're caught in the moment of the damnation based on their pride. Satan claims to be equal with God in the Christian tradition and is thrown out of heaven. Briareus makes an assault on Mount Olympus and is killed by Jupiter's lightning bolt. Nimrod tries to build his giant ziggurat up to heaven so that he can reach heaven and is struck with the confusion of languages. But in this tercet, Apollo, Athena, Mars, Jupiter, these are the victors. These are not the ones undone by pride. Those are the giants. And I think that's really important for us to see because it further highlights that there's some little shift happening in the middle of the passage itself. And I would argue it's happening all around Apollo. All this relates to why Dante uses funky name for Apollo. Why not just say, I saw Apollo, I saw Pallas, Athena, and Mars. And even that repetition of the phrase, I saw, it gets a little hurdy-gurdy right there. The rhythm isn't quite right. It's a little bit tight. Why doesn't Dante just name Apollo? Why use this weird circumlocution? Does it have something to do with Apollo being the god of poetry? And it could, because the references to Apollo are going to start to thicken in comedy from here on out. This is one of the first times. We have some other times, but one of the main first times we kind of see Apollo really on the scene. But the references to Apollo are going to start to grow over the course of Purgatorio and then really flower in Paradiso. And this is a problem, of course, because Apollo, while the god of poetry, is a pagan god, and the poetry he inspires would probably be seen as pagan poetry. Yet Dante wants to claim a kinship with Apollo. Is Dante uncomfortable at this moment? And so throws out this very learned name for Apollo Thymbraeus. Is Dante hedging his bets a little? Maybe, because here's the thing. Dante always sees the classical gods as precursors of Christian truths. Think about Capaneus amongst the blasphemers, and Capaneus undone by the bolt from Jupiter. You know, he got knocked down off the walls of Thebes because of a bolt from on high. And we talked about this. Can you blaspheme against Jupiter or Jove? Is that possible? Or Zeus? Can you blaspheme against these who are not real gods? And for Dante, the answer is kind of yes, because these are all precursors of the Christian God. But this is a minority stance. For most thinkers, these gods are pagan demons. I mean, Augustine is clear. The classical gods were demons, and there's no sense in honoring them in any way. Does Dante then use this circumlocution for Apollo, the god of poetry, because of his own rather interesting relationship with classical gods, which wouldn't be seen as the most orthodox relationship to them? Maybe, and especially because the references to Apollo are going to get bigger as we go forward. Let's talk just a minute about humility and pride, because that's what we're dealing with. We have seen the exemplars of humility, Mary, then David dancing in front of the ark, and then Trajan and the widow. And I'm still not sure, even after having wrestled with that passage forever, who is the example of humility? Is it Trajan or is it the widow? Which one of the two of them actually represents humility, or is humility actually the action found between the two of them? I'm still not settled there, but I can tell you those were all examples of humility, and now we've come out to the big examples of pride. And any Christian, especially in the Middle Ages, would see Lucifer, Satan here, falling out of heaven and instantly think pride. It is seen by all the theologians as the central sin, pride. Here's the problem. The signs of pride here are either action or just after action. So Satan claiming to be as high as God, or Briareus laying siege to Olympus, or those giants laying siege and being undone by Jupiter, Athena, Mars, Apollo, etc., or Nimrod building that tower. These are all actionable states in which people are moving forward in some way. And this brings up the question, back to those intaglios, of what then is humility? We saw Mary, we saw David, we saw Trajan. What is it that they were exemplifying exactly? And I want to start this discussion by telling you that there is a basic problem here. Humility, purity, and patience are voids. They're emptinesses. Purity, at its core, is a virtue made out of a lack. It means you haven't been sullied, you haven't had sex, that you haven't done something. That's the way you maintain your purity, is in stillness, by not moving, not acting. Humility, especially the way it gets practiced in some Christian traditions, suffers from a similar problem. It's stasis. I don't want to step on your toes, but the Virgin is the grand example of this. She submits to God. She doesn't necessarily do anything when she's told she's going to have a baby who will be the Messiah. She just submits to it. So humility is a disavowal, an emptiness. It's submission. Here's my big question to you, and we're going to tease this out over the next few episodes. Can a lack, or an emptiness, or a void, or a disavowal, can that be a virtue? Is it possible for the absence of something to be the virtue? Because what it seems like here is that pride is the presence of the action. It's moving in a certain way contrary to God. What's humility but submitting? It's attitudinal, shall we say. It's the way that you approach something. Submission or humility is often an admission. It's not an action. And can you make a real ethic without an action? Don't you need actions to be able to describe them as moral? Can you describe the lack of action as not a negative moral, but as the positive virtue? Purity, patience, the opposite of anger, humility, the opposite of pride. You're creating a binary ethic. Is a binary ethic truly able to comprehend human behavior? Now, I'm going to tell you right now, just to tell you where we're headed, my answer is ultimately going to be yes and no. So don't worry, that's where we're getting to, is an equivocated answer of yes and no. And in fact, you can call a lack a virtue, but you have to do certain things to make it so. Most ethics are predicated on action, on the will. Dante, the master of the will, is going to predicate everything on action. Dante's going to work this out. The solution is lying in front of us, but it is a problem of binary ethics. If you say, okay, picking up that rock is wrong. I'm being silly here. Picking up that rock is wrong. Well, then what's right? Not picking up that rock. How can the right thing being just don't do it? It's back to the apple or the pear in the Garden of Eden. Don't eat that fruit. Well, what's the right thing to do then? Don't eat that fruit. The right thing is not to make an action. We can build this out and say there are other ways to act. You don't have to focus on the fruit. You can go focus on the other flowers, etc. These are ways in which you can turn the lack into a virtue. But you have to work at it. Because ultimately, these key virtues, patience, purity, and humility, form emptinesses, voids, what you didn't do, or admissions, submissions, simply voiding out yourself. Is that truly, and can that truly be considered a virtue? The answer, I think we'll probably come to, is yes and no. I'm not going to read this passage at this point. I'm just going to leave it be. I'm going to come back when we get through all of these reliefs in the roadbed and read them all together. Next time on the podcast, we'll have that next set of reliefs carved into the roadbed, more figures that Dante sees as he walks along. I hope you see that this is not just a toss-off list. It's a heavily constructed list, and it's beautifully done, actually. And I hope that I'm helping you see a bit of the artistry here, and you can help me by leaving comments on my website, DMing me on social media, continuing the conversation there, rating this podcast, liking it, doing all those things. I so much appreciate it. Subscribe to it so you won't miss a single episode. Because how can you miss more reliefs of pride in the roadbed? I know it sounds dull, but actually it can be pretty fascinating when you really sit and tease it out. I'm Mark Scarborough, and I am ready to tease out what's next.